in the abdomen. The short one then raped her, she told the IA Shoe Flies. The broad-shouldered one had tried to rape her, but hadn't been able to get it up at first. He bit her several times on the breasts and face, and then he was able to get an erection, she told them, but he squirted all over my leg before he could get it in. Then he hit me some more. He told me he wanted to talk to me up close, but he did most of his talking with his fists. Now, lying in bed at the Whitestone, lying on sheets his wife had had in her hands, Norman rolled onto his side and tried to push 1985 away. It didn't want to go. No surprise there. Once it came, it never did. 1985 was a hanger around her, like some blabby asshole gas bag neighbor you just can't get rid of. We made a mistake, Norman thought. We believed that goddamn jig in the football jersey. Yes, that had been a mistake, all right, a rather big one. And they had believed that a woman who looked so much as if she belonged with a Richie Bender must be in Richie Bender's room, and that was either a second mistake or an extension of the first one, and it really didn't matter which, because the results were the same. Ms. Wendy Yarrow was a part-time waitress, a part-time hooker, and a full-time drug addict, but she had not been in Richie Bender's room, did not in fact know there was such a creature as Richie Bender on the planet. Richie Bender had turned out to be the man who had robbed the Payless and wasted the clerk, but his room wasn't between the soda machine and the newspaper boxes. That was Wendy Yarrow's room, and Wendy Yarrow had been all by herself, at least on that particular day. Richie Bender's room had been on the other side of the Coke machine. That mistake had almost cost Norman Daniels and Harley Bissington their jobs. But in the end, the IA people had believed the nail file story, and there had been no sperm to support Ms. Yarrow's claims of rape. Her assertion that the older of the two, the one who had actually gotten it into her, had used a condom and then flushed it down the toilet was not provable. There had been other problems, though. Even their greatest partisans in the department had to admit that Inspector Daniels and Bissington might have gone a little overboard in their efforts to subdue this 110-pound wildcat with a nail file. She did have quite a few broken fingers, for instance. Hence the official reprimand. Nor had that been the end of it. The uppity bitch had found that kike, that little bald-headed kike. But the world was full of uppity troublemaking bitches, his wife, for instance. But she was one uppity bitch he could do something about, always supposing that was he could get a little sleep. Norman rolled over onto his other side, and 1985 at last began to fade away. "When you least expect it, Rose," he murmured, "that's when I'll come for you." 5 minutes later, he was asleep.
"That slutty gal," he called her, Rose thought in her own bed. She was close to sleep herself now, but not there quite yet. She could still hear the crickets in the park. That slutty, high, yellow gal. Oh, how he hated her. Yes, of course he had. There had been a mess with the internal affairs investigators, for one thing. Norman and Harley Bissington had escaped from that with their skins intact, barely, only to discover that the slutty, high, yellow gal had found herself a lawyer, a bald-headed kike ambulance chaser, in Norman's speak, who had filed a huge civil suit on her behalf. It named Norman, Harley, the entire police department. Then, not long before Rosie's miscarriage, Wendy Yarrow had been murdered. She was found behind one of the grain elevators on the west side of the lake. She had been stabbed over 100 times, and her breasts had been hacked off. "Some sicko," Norman had told Rosie, and although he had not been smiling after he put the telephone down, someone at the cop shop must have been really excited to have called him at home, there had been undeniable satisfaction in his voice. "She sat in at the game once too often, and a wild card came out of the deck. Hazard of the job." He had touched her hair then, very gently, stroking it, and had smiled at her. Not his biting smile, the one that made her feel like screaming, but she'd felt like screaming anyway because she had known just like that what had happened to Wendy Yarrow, the slutty high yellow gal. "See how lucky you are," he'd asked her, now stroking the back of her neck with his big, hard hands, now her shoulders, now the swells of her breasts. "See how lucky you are not to be out on the street, Rose." Then, maybe it had been a month later, maybe 6 weeks, He had come in from the garage, found Rosie reading a romance novel, and decided he needed to talk to her about her entertainment tastes. Needed to talk to her about them right up close, in fact. 1985. A hell of a year. Rosie lay in bed with her hands under her pillow, slipping toward sleep and listening to the sounds of the crickets coming in through the window, so close they sounded as if her room had been magically transported onto the bandstand in the park. And she thought of a woman who had sat in the corner, with her hair plastered against her sweaty cheeks, and her belly as hard as a stone, and her eyes rolling in their shock-darkened sockets, as the sinister kisses began to tickle at her thighs. That woman who was still years from seeing the drop of blood on the sheet. That woman who had not known places like Daughters and Sisters or men like Bill Steiner existed. That woman who had crossed her arms and gripped the points of her shoulders and prayed to a god she no longer believed in, that it not be a miscarriage, that it not be the end of her small, sweet dream, and then thinking, as she felt it happening, that maybe it was better. She knew how Norman fulfilled his responsibilities as a husband. How might he fulfill them as a father? The soft hum of the crickets lulling her to sleep. And she could even smell grass, a husky, sweet aroma that seemed out of place in May. This was a smell she associated with August hayfields. I never smelled grass from the park before, she thought sleepily. Is this what love, infatuation at least, does to you? Does it sharpen your senses at the same time it's making you crazy? Very distantly, she heard a rumble that could have been thunder. That was strange, too, because the sky had been clear when Bill brought her home. She had looked up and marveled at how many stars she could see, even with all the orange high-intensity streetlights. She drifted, sliding away, sliding into the last dreamless sleep she would have for some time, and her final thought before the darkness claimed her was, "How can I hear crickets or smell grass? The window's not open. I closed it before I got into bed. Closed it and locked it." Crickets. Late that Wednesday afternoon, Rosie almost floated into the hot pot. She ordered a cup of tea and a pastry and sat by the window, slowly eating and drinking as she watched the endless river of pedestrians outside, most of them office workers at this hour, headed home for the day. The hot pot was actually out of her way now that she was no longer working at the Whitestone, but she'd come here unhesitatingly just the same, perhaps because she had so many pleasant after-work cups of tea here with Pam, perhaps because she wasn't much of an explorer, not yet at least, and this was a place she knew and trusted. She had finished reading the manta ray around 2 o'clock and had been reaching under the table for her purse when Rhoda Simons had clicked through on the speaker. "Do you want a little break before we start the next one, Rosie?" she had asked. And there it was, as simple as that. She had hoped she would get the other 3 Belle Racine novels, had believed she would. But the relief of actually knowing could not be matched. Nor was that all. When they had broken at 4, already 2 chapters into a lurid little slash-and-stalk thriller called Kill All My Tomorrows, Rhoda had asked Rosie if she would mind stepping down to the ladies' bathroom with her for a few minutes. "I know it sounds weird," she said, "but I am dying for a smoke, and it's the only place in the whole damn building I dare to sneak one. Modern life's a bitch, Rosie." In the bathroom, Rhoda had lit a Capri and perched on the sink ledge between the 2 basins with an ease that bespoke long familiarity. She crossed her legs, hooked her right foot behind her left calf, and looked at Rosie speculatively. "Love your hair," she said. Rosie touched it self-consciously. It was a spur-of-the-moment thing she'd done in a beauty shop the previous evening, $50 she could not afford, and had been unable not to spend. "Thanks," she said. "Robbie's going to offer you a contract, you know." Rosie frowned and shook her head. "No, I don't know. What are you talking about?" He may look like Mr. Pennybags on the Monopoly community chest cards, but Robbie's been in the audiobook biz since 1975, and he knows how good you are. He knows better than you do. You think you owe him a lot, don't you?
I know I do, Rosie replied stiffly. She didn't like the way this conversation was going. It made her think of those Shakespearean plays where people stabbed their friends in the back and then reeled off long, sanctimonious soliloquies explaining how unavoidable it had been.
Don't let your gratitude get in the way of your self-interest, Rhoda said, tapping cigarette ash neatly into the basin and chasing it with a squirt of cold water. I don't know the story of your life, and I don't particularly want to know it, but I know you did the manta ray in just 104 takes, which is fucking phenomenal. And I know you sound like the young Elizabeth Taylor. I also know, because it's just about taped to your forehead, that you're on your own and not used to it. You're so tabula rasa, it's scary. Do you know what that means? Rosie wasn't entirely sure. Something about being naive, she thought, but she wasn't going to let on to Rhoda.
Yes, of course.
Good, and don't get me wrong, for Christ's sake. I'm not trying to cut in on Robbie or cut my own piece out of your cake. I'm rooting for you. So's Rob, and so's Curtis. It's just that Rob's also rooting for his wallet. Audiobooks is still a brand new field. If this were the movie business, we'd be halfway through the age of the silence. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Sort of.
When Robbie listens to you reading The Manta Ray, he's thinking of an audio version of Mary Pickford. I know that sounds crazy, but it's true. Even the way he met you adds to that. There's a legend about Lana Turner being discovered in Schwab's drugstore. Well, Robbie's already making a legend in his own mind about how he discovered you in his friend Steiner's pawn shop looking at antique postcards.
Is that what he told you I was doing? She asked, feeling a surge of warmth for Robbie Lefferts that was almost love.
Uh-huh, but where he found you and what you were doing there doesn't really matter. The fact is that you're good, Rosie. You're really, really talented. It's almost as if you were born to this job. Rob discovered you, but that doesn't give him a right to your pipes for the rest of your life. Don't let him own you.
He'd never want to do that, Rosie said. She was frightened and excited at the same time, and also a little angry at Rhoda for being so cynical. But all of these feelings had been suppressed beneath a bright layer of joy and relief. She was going to be all right for a little longer. And if Robbie really did offer her a contract, she might be all right for even longer than that. It was all very well for Rhoda Simons to preach caution. Rhoda wasn't living in a single room, 3 blocks from an area of town where you didn't park your car at the curb if you wanted to keep your radio and your hubcaps. Rhoda had an accountant husband, a house in the suburbs, and a 1994 silver Nissan. Rhoda had a Visa and an American Express card. Better yet, Rhoda had a Blue Cross card and savings she could draw on if she got sick and couldn't work. For people who had those things, Rosie imagined, advising caution in business affairs was probably as natural as breathing.
Maybe not, Rhoda said, but you could be a small gold mine, Rosie, and sometimes people change when they discover gold mines. Even nice people, like Robbie Lefferts. Now, drinking her tea and looking out the window of the hot pot, Rosie remembered Rhoda dousing her cigarette under the cold tap, dropping it in the trash, and then coming over to her. I know you're in a situation where job security is very important to you, and I'm not saying Robbie's a bad man. I've been working with him off and on since 1982, and I know he's not. But I'm telling you to keep an eye on the birds in the bush while you're making sure the one in your hand doesn't fly away. Do you follow me?
Not entirely, no.
Agree to do 6 books to start with, no more. 8 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon, right here at Tape Engine. $1,000 a week. Rosie goggled at her, feeling as if someone had stuck a vacuum cleaner hose down her throat and sucked the air out of her lungs.
$1,000 a week? Are you crazy?
Ask Kurt Hamilton if he thinks I'm crazy, Rhoda said calmly. Remember, it's not just the voice, it's the takes. You did the manta ray in 104. No one else I work with could have done it in less than 200.
You have great voice management, but the absolutely incredible thing is your breath control. If you don't sing, how in God's name did you get such great control? A nightmarish image had occurred to Rosie then. Sitting in the corner with her kidneys swelling and throbbing like bloated bags filled with hot water. Sitting there with her apron held in her hands, praying to God she wouldn't have to fill it because it hurt to throw up. It made her kidneys feel as if they were being stabbed with long, splintery sticks. Sitting there, breathing in long, flat inhales and slow, soft exhales, because that was what worked best. Trying to make the runaway beat of her heart match the calmer rhythm of her respiration. Sitting there and listening to Norman making himself a sandwich in the kitchen and singing Daniel or Take a Letter, Maria, in his surprisingly good barroom tenor. I don't know, she had told Rhoda. I didn't even know what breath control was until I met you. I guess it's just a gift. Well, count your blessings, kid, Rhoda said. We better get back. Kurt'll think we're practicing weird female rituals in here. Robbie had called from his office downtown to congratulate her on finishing the manta ray, just as she was getting ready to leave for the day, this had been. And although he hadn't specifically mentioned a contract, he had asked if she would have lunch with him on Friday to discuss what he called a business arrangement. Rosie had agreed and hung up, feeling bemused. She remembered thinking that Rhoda's description of him was perfect. Robbie Lefferts did look like the little man on the Monopoly cards. When she put down the telephone in Curtis's private office, a cluttery little closet with hundreds of business cards stuck to the cork walls on pushpins, and went back out into the studio to collect her purse, Rhoda was gone, presumably for a final smoke in the ladies. Kurt was marking boxes of reel-to-reel tape. He looked up and gave her a grin. Great work today, Rosie.
Thanks.
Rhoda says Robbie's going to offer you a contract.
That's what she says, Rosie agreed. And I actually think she might be right.
Knock on wood.
Well, you ought to remember one thing while you're dickering, Curtis said, putting the tape boxes on a high shelf where dozens of similar boxes were ranged like thin white books. If you made $500 for the manta ray, Robbie's already ahead of the game, because you saved maybe $700 in studio time. Get it?
She'd gotten it, all right. And now she sat here in the hot pot with the future looking unexpectedly bright. She had friends, a place to live, a job, and the promise of more work when she had finished with Christina Bell. A contract that might mean as much as $1,000 a week, more money than Norman made. It was crazy, but it was true. Might be true, she amended. Oh, and one other thing. She had a date for Saturday. All of Saturday, if you counted in the Indigo Girls concert that night. Rosie's face, usually so solemn, broke into a brilliant smile, and she felt a totally inappropriate desire to hug herself. She took the last bite of her pastry and looked out the window again, wondering if all these things could possibly be happening to her, if there could actually be a real life where real people walked out of their prisons, turned right, and walked into heaven. Half a block away, Don't Walk went out, and Walk came on. Pam Haverford, now changed out of her white chambermaid's uniform and into a pair of trim red slacks, crossed the street with 24 other people. She had worked an extra hour tonight and had no reason on earth to think Rosie would be in the hot pot, but she did think it just the same. Call it woman's intuition if you wanted. She glanced briefly at the big lug crossing beside her, who she thought she had seen at the White Stone newsstand a few minutes ago. He might have qualified as someone interesting if not for the look in his eyes, which was no look at all. He glanced briefly at her as they stepped up on the far curb, and the lack of expression in those eyes, the feeling of some absence behind them, actually chilled her. Inside the hot pot, Rosie abruptly decided she wanted a second cup of tea. She had no earthly reason to think Pam might drop in. It was a full hour past their usual time, but she did just the same. Maybe it was woman's intuition. She got up and turned toward the counter.
The little bitch beside him was sort of cute, Norman thought. Tight red slacks, nice little ass. He dropped back a couple of steps, the better to enjoy the view, my dear. But almost as soon as he did, she turned into a little restaurant. Norman glanced in the window as he went by, but saw nothing interesting, just a bunch of old bags eating gooey shit and slopping up coffee and tea, plus a few waiters rushing around in that mincing, faggy way they had. The old ladies must like it, Norman thought. Fag walking like that must pay off in tips. It had to. Why else would grown men walk that way? They couldn't all be fags. Could they? His gaze into the hot pot, brief and disinterested, touched on one lady considerably younger than the blue-rinsed, pants-suited type sitting at most of the tables. She was walking away from the window and toward the cafeteria-style serving counter at the far end of the tea room. At least, he supposed that was what you call places like this. He took a quick look at her ass, simply because that was where his eyes always went first when it was a woman younger than 40, judged it not too bad, but nothing to write home to Mother about. Rose's ass used to look like that, he thought, back in the days before she let herself go and it got as big as a goddamn footstool, that is. The woman he glimpsed through the window also had great hair, much better than a fanny, actually, but her hair didn't make him think of Rosie. Rosie was what Norman's mother had always called a brownette, and she rarely took any pains with her hair. Given its lackluster mousehide color, Norman didn't blame her. Pulling it back in a ponytail and securing it with a rubber band was her usual way of wearing it. If they were going out to dinner or a movie, she might thread it through one of those elastic scrunch things they sold in the drugstore. The woman upon whom Norman's gaze touched briefly when he looked into the hot pot was not a brownette but a slim-hip blonde, and her hair was not in a ponytail or a scrunch. It hung down to the middle of her back in a carefully made plait.
Perhaps the best thing to happen all day, even better than Rhoda's stunning news that she might be worth $1,000 a week to Robbie Lefferts, was the look on Pam Haverford's face when Rosie turned away from the hot pot cash register with her fresh cup of tea. At first, Pam's eyes slid over her with absolutely no recognition at all, and then they snapped back, widening as they did so. Pam started to grin and then actually shrieked, probably pushing at least half a dozen pacemakers in the ferny little room dangerously close to overload. "Rosie? Is that you? Oh, my God!" "It's me," Rosie said, laughing and blushing. She was aware that people were turning to look at them and discovered, wonder of wonders, that she did not exactly mind. They took their tea to their old table by the window, and Rosie even allowed Pam to talk her into another pastry, although she had lost 15 pounds since coming to the city and had no intention of putting it back on if she could help it. Pam kept telling her that she couldn't believe it, simply couldn't believe it. A remark Rosie might have been tempted to chalk up to flattery, except for the way Pam's eyes kept moving from her face to her hair, as if she was trying to get the truth of it straight in her mind. "It makes you look 5 years younger," she said. "Hell, Rosie, it makes you look like jailbait." "For $50, it ought to make me look like Marilyn Monroe," Rosie replied, smiling. But since her talk with Rhoda, she felt a lot easier in her mind about the amount she'd spent on her hair. "Where did you..." Pam began, then stopped. "It's the picture you bought, isn't it? You had your hair done the same as the woman in the picture." Rosie thought she would blush at this, but no blush came. She simply nodded. "I loved that style, so I thought I'd try it." She hesitated, then added, "As for changing the color, I still can't believe I did it. It's the first time in my whole life that I've changed the color of my hair." "The first? I don't believe it." "It's true." Pam leaned across the table, and when she spoke, it was in a throaty, conspiratorial whisper. "It's happened, hasn't it?" "What are you talking about? What's happened?" "You've met someone interesting." Rosie opened her mouth, closed it, opened it again without the slightest idea of what she intended to say. It turned out to be nothing. What came out instead of words was laughter. She laughed until she cried, and before she was done, Pam had joined in. Rosie didn't need her key to open the street door at 897 Trenton Street. That one was left unlocked until 8 or so on weeknights. but she needed the small one to open her mailbox. R. McClendon, taped to the front of it, boldly asserting that she belonged here, yes she did, which was empty except for a Walmart circular. As she started up the stairs to the second floor, she shook out another key. This one opened the door to her room, and except for the building super, she had the only one. Like the mailbox, it was hers. Her feet were tired. She had walked the entire 3 miles from downtown, feeling too restless and too happy to sit on a bus, also wanting more time than a bus would give her to think and dream. She was hungry, in spite of 2 hot pot pastries, but her stomach's low growling added rather than detracted from her happiness. Had she ever in her life felt such gladness? She thought not. It had spilled over from her mind into her entire body, and although her feet were tired, they still felt light. And her kidneys didn't hurt a bit, in spite of the long walk. Now, letting herself into her room, and remembering to lock the door behind her this time, Rosie began to giggle again. Pam and her someone interestings. She had been forced to admit a few things. She was, after all, planning to bring Bill to the Indigo Girls concert on Saturday night, and the women from D&S would meet him then. But when she protested that she hadn't colored her hair and plaited it simply on Bill's account, this felt true to her, actually. She got only comically rolling eyeballs and a burlesque wink from Pam. It was irritating, but also rather sweet. She opened the window, letting in the mild late spring air and the sounds of the park, then crossed to her small kitchen table, where a paperback lay beside the flowers Bill had brought her on Monday night. The flowers were fading now, but she didn't think she could bring herself to throw them out, not at least until after Saturday. Last night she had dreamed of him, had dreamed of riding behind him on his motorcycle. He kept driving faster and faster, and at some point a terrible, wonderful word had occurred to her, a magic word. She couldn't remember exactly what it had been now, something nonsensical like defel or feffel, but in the dream it had seemed like a beautiful word, powerful too. "Don't say it unless you really, really mean it," she remembered thinking as they flashed along some country highway, with hills on the left and the lake winking blue and gold sunflashes through the firs on their right. Up ahead was an overgrown hill, and she knew that there was a ruined temple on the far side of it. "Don't say it unless you mean to commit yourself, body and soul." She had said the word. It came out of her mouth like a bolt of electricity. The wheels of Bill's Harley had left the road. For just a moment she had seen the front one still spinning, but now 6 inches above the pavement, and she had seen their shadow not beside them, but somehow beneath them. Bill had twisted the hand throttle, and suddenly they were bolting up toward the bright blue sky, emerging from the lane the road made in the trees like a submarine coming to the surface of the ocean. And she had awakened in her bed with the covers balled up all around her, shivering and yet gasping in the hold of some deep heat which seemed hidden in the center of her, unseen but powerful, like the sun in eclipse. She doubted very much if they would fly like that, no matter how many magic words she tried. But she thought she would keep the flowers a while longer anyway. Perhaps even press a couple of them between the pages of this very book. She had bought the book in Elaine's Dreams, the place where she had gotten her hair done. The title was Simple But Elegant, 10 Hairstyles You Can Do at Home. "These are good," Elaine told her. "Of course, you should always get your hair done by a professional. That's my view. But if you can't afford it every week, time-wise or money-wise, and the thought of actually dialing the 800 number and ordering the topsy tail makes you feel like shooting yourself, this is a decent compromise. Just for Jesus' sake, promise me that if some guy invites you to a country club dance in Westwood, you'll come see me first." Rosie sat down and turned to style number 3, the classic plait, which the opening paragraph informed her was also known as the classic French braid. She went through the black and white photographs which showed a woman first separating and then plaiting her hair, and when she reached the end, she began to work her way backward, undoing the plait. Unmaking it in the evening turned out to be a lot simpler than making it in the morning.
It had taken her 45 minutes and one good round of cursing to get it looking more or less the way it had when she'd left Elaine's dreams the night before. It had been worth it, however. Pam's unabashed shriek of amazement in the hot pot was worth all of that and more. As she finished her work, her mind turned to Bill Steiner. It had never been very far away from him, and she wondered if he would like her hair plaited, if he would like her hair blonde, or if he would, in fact, notice either of these changes at all. She wondered if she would be unhappy if he didn't notice, then sighed and wrinkled her nose. Of course she would be. On the other hand, what if he not only noticed, but reacted as Pam had, minus the squeal, of course. He might even sweep her into his arms, as they said in the romance novels. She was reaching for her purse, wanting the comb inside, and beginning to slide into a harmless little fantasy of Saturday morning, of Bill tying the end of the plait with a piece of velvet ribbon. In fact, why he would happen to have a piece of velvet ribbon on his person could go completely unexplained. That was the nice thing about kitchen table daydreams. When her thoughts were interrupted by a small sound from the far side of the room. Reep, reep, reep. A cricket. The sound wasn't coming through the open window from Bryant Park, either. It was a lot closer than that. Reep, 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 reep. She swept her eyes along the baseboard and saw something jump. She got up, opened the cupboard to the left of the sink, and took down a glass mixing bowl. She walked across the room, pausing to pluck the Walmart circular from the seat of the chair in the living room area. Then she knelt by the insect, which had made its way almost into the unadorned south corner, where she supposed she would put her TV, if she actually got around to buying one before moving out of here. After today, moving to a bigger place, and soon, seemed like more than just a daydream. It was a cricket. How it had gotten up here to the second floor was a bit of a mystery, but it was definitely a cricket. Then the answer occurred to her, and it included the reason why she'd heard it when she was falling asleep. The cricket must have come up with Bill, probably in the cuff of his pants, a little extra present to go along with the flowers. You didn't hear just one cricket the other night, Practical Sensible spoke up suddenly. That particular voice hadn't gotten much use lately. It sounded rusty and a little hoarse. You heard a whole fieldful of crickets, or a whole parkful. Bullshit, she replied comfortably as she lowered the bowl over the insect and then slid the advertising circular under the lip, poking the bug with the corner of it until he hopped, letting her slide the paper entirely over the inverted mouth of the bowl. My mind just turned one cricket into a chorus, that's all. I was going to sleep, remember? I was probably half in a dream already. She picked the bowl up and turned it over, holding the circular over the top so the cricket couldn't escape before she was ready for it to. It jumped energetically up and down, meanwhile, its armored back ticking off a picture of the new John Grisham novel, which could be purchased at Walmart for only $16 plus tax. Humming, "When You Wish Upon a Star," Rosie took the cricket over to the open window, removed the circular, and held the bowl out into space. Insects could fall from much greater heights than this and walk away unhurt. Hop away, her mind amended, when they landed. She was sure she had read that somewhere, or perhaps seen it on some TV nature program. Go on, Jiminy, she said. Be a good boy and hop. See the park over there? Tall grass, plenty of dew to drink, lots of girl crick. She broke off. The bug hadn't come upstairs in Bill's cuffs, because he'd been wearing jeans on Monday night when he'd taken her out to dinner. She questioned her memory on that, wanting to be sure, and the same information came back quickly and with no shade of doubt. Oxford shirt and Levi's with no cuffs. She remembered being comforted by his clothes. They were insurance that he wasn't going to try taking her to some fancy place where she would be stared at. Blue jeans, no cuffs. So where had Jiminy come from? What did it matter? If the cricket hadn't come upstairs in one of Bill's pants cuffs, it had probably come up in someone else's, that was all, hopping out on the second floor landing when it got a little restless. Hey, thanks for the ride, bud. Then it had simply slipped under her door, and what of that? She could think of less pleasant uninvited guests.
As if to express agreement with this, the cricket suddenly sprang out of the bowl and took the plunge. "Have a nice day," Rosie said. "Stop by any time. Really." As she brought the bowl back inside, a minor gust of wind blew the Walmart circular out from beneath her thumb and sent it seesawing lazily to the floor. She bent over to pick it up, then froze with her outstretched fingers still an inch away from it. Two more crickets, both dead, lay against the baseboard, one on its side and the other on its back with its little legs sticking up. One cricket she could understand and accept, but three? In a second-floor room? How exactly did you explain that? Now Rosie saw something else, something lying in the crack between two boards close to the dead crickets. She knelt, fished it out of the crack, and held it up to her eyes. It was a clover flower, a tiny pink clover flower. She looked down at the crack from which she had plucked it. She looked again at the pair of dead crickets. Then she let her eyes climb slowly up the cream-colored wall, to her picture, hanging there by the window. To Rose Madder, it was as good a name as any, standing on her hill, with a newly discovered pony cropping grass behind her. Conscious of her heartbeat, a big, slow, muffled drum in her ears, Rosie leaned forward toward the picture, toward the pony's snout, watching the image dissolve into layered shades of old paint, beginning to see the brushstrokes. Below the muzzle were the forest green and olive green hues of the grass, which appeared to have been done in quick layered downstrokes of the artist's brush. Dotted among them were small pink blobs. Clover. Rose looked at the tiny pink flower in the palm of her hand, then held it out to the painting. The color matched exactly. Suddenly, and with no forethought at all, she raised her hand to the level of her lips and puffed the tiny flower toward the picture. She half expected—no, it was more than that, actually. For a moment she was utterly positive. The tiny pink ball would float through the surface of the painting and enter that world which had been created by some unknown artist 60, 80, perhaps even 100 years ago. It didn't happen, of course. The pink flower struck the glass covering the painting— unusual for an oil to be covered with glass, Robbie had said on the day she met him, bounced off and fluttered to the floor like a tiny shred of balled-up tissue paper. Maybe the painting was magic, but the glass covering it certainly wasn't. Then how did the crickets get out? You do think that's what's happened, don't you? That the crickets and the clover flower somehow got out of the painting? God help her, that was what she thought. She had an idea that when she was out of the room and with other people, the notion would seem ridiculous or fade away completely. But for now, that was what she thought. The crickets had hopped out of the grass under the feet of the blonde woman in the Rose Madder chiton. They had somehow hopped from the world of Rose Madder and into that of Rosie McClendon. How? Did they just sort of ooze through the glass? No, of course not. That was stupid, but... She reached out with hands that trembled slightly and lifted the painting off its hook. She took it into the kitchen area, set it on the counter, and then turned it around. The charcoaled words on the paper backing were more blurred than ever. She wouldn't have known for sure that they said Rose Madder if she hadn't seen them earlier. Hesitantly, feeling afraid now... Or perhaps she'd been afraid all along and was just now beginning to realize it. She touched the backing. It crackled when she poked it. Crackled too much. And when she poked at it lower down, where the brown paper disappeared into the frame, she felt something. Some things. She swallowed, and the back of her throat was so dry it hurt. She opened one of the counter drawers with a hand that didn't feel like her own, picked up a paring knife, and brought its blade slowly toward the brown paper backing. "Don't do it!" Practical Sensible shrieked. "Don't do it, Rosie! You don't know what might come out of there!" She held the tip of the knife poised against the brown paper for a moment, then laid it aside for the time being. She lifted the picture and looked at the bottom of the frame, noting with some distant part of her mind that her hands were shaking very badly now.
What she saw now running through the wood, a crack at least a quarter inch across at its widest point, didn't really surprise her. She set the picture back down on the counter, holding it up with her right hand and using her left, her smart hand, to bring the tip of the paring knife against the paper backing again. "Don't, Rosie." Practical Sensible wasn't shrieking this time. She was moaning. "Please, don't do this. Please leave well enough alone." Except that was ridiculous advice when you thought about it. If she had followed it the first time Ms. P.S. had given it, she would still be living with Norman, or dying with him. She used the knife to slit the backing down low where she felt those bulges. Half a dozen crickets tumbled out onto the counter, four of them dead, one twitching feebly. The sixth, frisky enough to hop off down the counter before tumbling into the sink. Along with the crickets came a few more pink clover puffs, a few grass cuttings, and part of a brown dead leaf. Rosie picked this last up and looked at it curiously. It was an oak leaf. She was almost sure of it. Working carefully and ignoring the voice of Practical Sensible, Rosie used the paring knife to cut all the way round the paper backing. When she removed it, more rustic treasures fell out. Ants, most dead, but three or four still able to crawl. The plump corpse of a honeybee. Several daisy petals of the sort you were supposed to pluck from the central flower while chanting, "He loves me, he loves me not." And a few filmy white hairs. She held these up to the light, gripping the turned-around painting tighter with her right hand as a shudder went up her back, like big feet climbing a set of stairs. If she took these hairs to a veterinarian and asked him to look at them under a microscope, Rosie knew what he'd tell her. They were horsehairs. Or, more accurately, they were hairs from a small, shaggy pony. A pony that was currently cropping grass in another world. "I'm losing my mind," she thought calmly, and that wasn't the voice of Practical Sensible. That was her own voice. The one which spoke for the central, integrated core of her thoughts and herself. It wasn't hysterical or goosey. It spoke rationally, calmly, and with a touch of wonder. It was, she suspected, the same tone in which her mind would acknowledge the inevitability of death, in the days or weeks when its approach could no longer be denied. Except she didn't really believe she was losing her mind. Not the way she would be forced to believe in the finality of, say, cancer once it had progressed to a certain stage. She had opened the back of her picture and a bunch of grass, hair, and insects, some still alive, had fallen out. Was that so impossible to believe? She had read a story in the newspaper a few years back about a woman who had discovered a small fortune in perfectly good stock certificates hidden in the backing of an old family portrait. Compared to that, a few bugs seemed mundane. But still alive, Rosie? And what about the clover, still fresh, and the grass, still green? The leaf was dead, but you know what you're thinking about that. She was thinking that it had blown through dead. It was summer in the picture, but you found dead leaves in the grass, even in June. So, I repeat, I'm losing my mind. Except the stuff was here, scattered all over her kitchen counter, a litter of bugs and grass. Stuff. Not dreams or hallucinations, but real stuff. And there was something else. The one thing she did not really want to approach head on. This picture had talked to her. No, not out loud, but from the first moment she'd seen it, it had spoken to her just the same. It had her name on the back, a version of it anyway, and yesterday she had spent much more than she could afford to make her hair look like the hair of the woman in the picture. Moving with sudden decisiveness, she inserted the flat of the paring knife's blade under the top part of the frame and levered upward. She would have stopped immediately if she had sensed strong resistance. This was the only paring knife she had, and she didn't want to snap the blade off. But the nails holding the frame together gave easily. She pulled off the top, now using her free hand to keep the glass front from falling to the counter and shattering, and laid it aside. Another dead cricket clicked to the counter. A moment later, she held the bare canvas in her hands. It was about 30 inches long and 18 inches high, with the frame and the matting removed. Gently, Rose ran her finger across the long, dried oil paints, feeling layers of minutely different heights, feeling even the fine-combed tracks left by the artist's brush. It was an interesting, slightly eerie sensation, but there was nothing supernatural about it. Her finger did not slip through the surface and into that other world. The phone, which she had bought and plugged into the wall jack yesterday, rang for the first time. The volume was turned up all the way, and its sudden shrill warble made Rosie jump and voice her own cry. Her hand tensed, and her outstretched finger almost poked through the painted canvas. She laid the picture down on the kitchen table and hurried to the phone, hoping it was Bill. If it was, she thought she might invite him over. Invite him to take a good look at her painting, and show him the assorted detritus that had fallen out of it, the stuff. Hello? Hello, Rosie? Not Bill, a woman. It's Anna Stevenson. Oh, Anna, hello. How are you? From the sink came a persistent reep, reep. I'm not doing too well, Anna said. Not too well at all. Something very unpleasant has happened, and I need to tell you about it. It may not have anything to do with you. I hope with all my heart it doesn't. But it might. Rosie sat down, frightened now in a way she hadn't been even when she had felt the shapes of dead insects hiding behind the backing of her picture. What, Anna? What's wrong? Rosie listened with growing horror as Anna told her. When she had finished, she asked if Rosie wanted to come over to Daughters and Sisters, perhaps spend the night. I don't know, Rosie said numbly. I'll have to think. Anna, I have to call someone else now. I'll get back to you. She hung up before Anna could reply, dialed 411, asked for a number, got it, dialed it. Liberty City, an older man's voice said. Yes, may I speak to Mr. Steiner? This is Mr. Steiner, the slightly hoarse voice replied, sounding amused. Rosie was confused for a moment, then remembered that he was in business with his dad. Bill, she said. Her throat was dry and painful again. Bill, I mean, is he there?
Hold on, miss. A rustle and a clunk as the phone was laid down, and distant, Billy, it's a lady for you.
Rosie closed her eyes. Very distantly, she heard the cricket in the sink. Reep, reep. A long, unbearable pause. A tear slipped out from beneath the lashes of her left eye and started down her cheek. It was followed by one from her right, and a snatch of some old country song drifted through her mind.
Well, the race is on, and here comes pride up the backstretch. Heartache is going to the inside.
She wiped them away. So many tears she had wiped away in this life of hers. If the Hindus were right about reincarnation, she hated to think what she must have been in her last one. The telephone was picked up. Hello? A voice she now heard in her dreams. Hello, Bill. It wasn't her normal speaking voice, not even a whisper, not really. It was more like the husk of a whisper.
I can't hear you, Bill said. Can you speak up, ma'am?
She didn't want to speak up. She wanted to hang up. She couldn't, though. Because if Anna was right, Bill could be in trouble, too. Very bad trouble. If, that was, he was perceived by a certain someone as being a little too close to her. She cleared her throat and tried again.
Bill, it's Rosie.
Rosie, he cried, sounding delighted. Hey, how are you?
His unaffected, undisguised delight only made it worse. All of a sudden, it felt as if someone were twisting a knife in her guts.
I can't go out with you on Saturday, she said, speaking rapidly. The tears were coming faster now, oozing from beneath her eyelids like some nasty, hot grease. I can't go out with you at all. I was crazy to think I could.
Of course you can. Jesus, Rosie, what are you talking about?
The panic in his voice, not the anger she had half expected, but real panic, was bad, but somehow the bewilderment was worse. She couldn't stand it.
Don't call me, and don't come over, she told him, and suddenly she could see Norman with horrible clarity, standing across from her building in the pouring rain with the collar of his overcoat turned up and a streetlight faintly illuminating the lower half of his face, standing there like one of the hellish, brutal villains in a novel by Richard Racine. Rosie, I don't understand.
I know, and that's actually for the best, she said. Her voice was wavering, starting to break apart. Just stay away from me, Bill.
She hung the phone up quickly, stared at it a moment, then voiced a loud, agonized cry. She turned the phone out of her lap with the backs of her hands. The handset flew to the end of its cord and lay on the floor, its open-line hum sounding strangely like the hum of the crickets which had sent her off to sleep on Monday night. Suddenly, she couldn't stand the sound, felt that if she had to listen to it for even another 30 seconds, it would split her head in two. She got up, went to the wall, squatted, and pulled the phone jack. When she tried to get up again, her trembling legs would not support her. She sat on the floor, covered her face with her hands, and let the tears have their way with her. There was really no choice. Anna had kept saying over and over again that she wasn't sure, that Rosie couldn't be sure either, whatever she might suspect. But Rosie was sure. It was Norman. Norman was here. Norman had lost whatever remained of his sanity. Norman had killed Anna's ex-husband, Peter Slowick. And Norman was looking for her.
Five blocks beyond the Hot Pot, where he had come within 4 seconds of meeting his wife's eyes through the plate glass window, Norman turned into a discount store called No More Than Five. Everything in the store priced under $5, the store's motto read. It was printed below a wretchedly executed drawing of Abraham Lincoln. There was a broad grin on Lincoln's bearded face. He was dropping a wink, and to Norman Daniels, he looked quite a bit like a man he had once arrested for strangling his wife and all four of his children. In this store, which was literally within shouting distance of Liberty City Loan and Pawn, Norman bought all the disguise he intended to wear today, a pair of sunglasses and a cap with chai socks printed above the bill. As a man with just over 10 years' experience as a detective inspector, Norman had come to believe that disguises only belonged in three places: spy movies, Sherlock Holmes stories, and Halloween parties. They were especially useless in the daytime, when the only thing makeup looked like was makeup, and the only thing a disguise looked like was a disguise. And the gals and daughters and sisters, the New Age whorehouse where his pal Peter Slowick had finally admitted sending his rambling rose, were apt to be particularly sensitive to predators slinking around their waterhole. For gals like these, paranoia was a lot more than a way of life. It was full state-of-the-art. The cap and dark glasses would serve his purpose. All he had planned for this early evening was what Gordon Satterwhite, his first detective partner, would have called a little recce. Gordon had also been fond of grabbing his young associate and telling him it was time to do a little of what he called the old gumshoe. Gordon had been a fat, smelly, tobacco-chewing slob with brown teeth, and Norman had despised him almost from the first moment he had seen him. Gordon had been a cop for 26 years and an inspector for 19, but he had no feel for the work. Norman did. He didn't like it, and he hated the jizzbags he had to talk to and sometimes even associate with if the job was undercover. But he had a feel for it, and that feel had been invaluable over the years. It had helped bring him through the case which had resulted in his promotion, the case which had turned him, however briefly, into a media golden boy. In that investigation, as in most that involved organized crime, there came a point where the path the investigators had been following disappeared into a bewildering maze of diverging paths, and the straightway was lost. The difference in the drug case was that Norman Daniels was, for the first time in his career, in charge, and when logic failed, he did without hesitation what most cops could not or would not do. He had switched over to intuition and then trusted his entire future to what it told him, plunging forward aggressively and fearlessly. To Norman, there was no such thing as a little recce. To Norman, there was only trolling. When you were stumped, you went somewhere that had a bearing on the case, You looked at it with your mind perfectly open, not junked up with a lot of worthless ideas and half-baked suppositions. And when you did that, you were like a guy sitting in a slow-moving boat, casting your line out and reeling it in, casting out and reeling in, waiting for something to grab hold. Sometimes nothing did. Sometimes you got nothing but a submerged tree limb or an old rubber boot or the kind of fish not even a hungry raccoon would eat. Sometimes, though, you hooked a tasty one. He put on the hat and the sunglasses, then turned left onto Harrison Street, now on his way to Durham Avenue. It was easily a 3-mile hike to the neighborhood where Daughters and Sisters was located, but Norman didn't mind. He could use the walk to empty out his head. By the time he reached 251, he would be like a blank sheet of photographic paper, ready to receive whatever images and ideas might come without trying to change them, so they would fit his own preconceptions. If you didn't have any preconceptions, you couldn't do that. His overpriced map was in his back pocket, but he only stopped to consult it once. He had been in the city less than a week, but he already had its geography much more clearly fixed in his mind than Rosie did, and again, this was not so much training as it was a gift. When he had awakened yesterday morning with his hands and shoulders and groin aching, with his jaws too sore to open his mouth much more than halfway, the first attempt at a wake-up yawn as he swung his feet out of bed had been agony. He had done so with the dismaying realization that what he had done to Peter Slowick, a.k.a. Thumperstein, a.k.a. the amazing urban Jew boy, had probably been a mistake. Just how bad a mistake was hard to say, because a lot of what had happened at Slowick's house was only a blur to him, but it had been a mistake, all right. By the time he had reached the hotel newsstand, he'd decided there was no probably about it. Probably was for the dinks of the world anyway. This had been an unspoken but fiercely held tenet of his life's code ever since his early teens, when his mother had left and his father had really started to crank up the beatings. He had bought a paper at the newsstand and leafed through it rapidly in the elevator as he went back up to his room. There was nothing in it about Peter Slowick, but Norman had found that only a minor relief. Thumper's body might not have been discovered in time for the news to make the early editions, might in fact still be lying where Norman had left it. Where he thought he had left it, he amended, it was all pretty hazy. Crammed in behind the basement water heater. But guys like Thumper, guys who did lots of public service work and had lots of bleeding heart friends, didn't go undiscovered for long. Someone would get worried, other someones would come around looking for him at his cozy little rabbit hole on Beaudry Place, and eventually, someone would make an exceptionally unpleasant discovery behind the water heater. And sure enough, what had not been in the paper yesterday morning was there today, on page 1 of the Metro section, City Social Workers Slain in Home. According to the piece, Traveler's Aid had been only one of Thumper's after-hours activities, and he hadn't exactly been poor either. According to the paper, his family, of which Thump had been the last, had been worth a pretty good chunk of change. The fact that he had been working in a bus station at 3 in the morning, sending runaway wives to the whores at Daughters and Sisters, only proved to Norman that the man was either short a few screws or sexually bent. Anyway, he had been your typical do-gooding shitbug, trundling here and there, too busy trying to save the world most days to change his underpants. Traveler's Aid, Salvation Army, Dial Help, Bosnian Relief, Russian Relief, you'd have thought a Jew boy like Thump would have had at least enough sense to skip that one, but nope. And 2 or 3 women's causes as well. The paper didn't identify these last, but Norman already knew one of them, Daughters and Sisters, also known as Lesbo Babes in Toyland. There was going to be a memorial service for Thumper on Saturday, except the paper called it a remembrance circle. Dear Bleeding Jesus. He also knew that Slowick's death could have had to do with any of the causes the man worked for, or none of them. The cops would be checking into his personal life as well, always assuming a walking room to rent like Thumper had a personal life, and they would not neglect the possibility that it had been the ever more popular motiveless crime committed by some psycho who maybe just happened to walk in, a guy looking for a bite, you could say. None of these things, however, were going to matter much to the whores at Daughters and Sisters. Norman knew that as well as he knew his own name. He'd had a fair amount of experience with women's halfway houses and shelters in the course of his job, more as the years went by and the people Norman thought of as the New Age fern sniffers really started to have an effect on the way people thought and behaved. According to the New Age fern sniffers, everyone came from a dysfunctional family, everyone was sublimating the child inside, and everyone had to watch out for all the mean, nasty people out there who had the nerve to try going through life without whining and crying and running off to some 12-step program every night. The fern sniffers were assholes, but some of them, and the women in places like this, daughters and sisters, were often prime examples.